Well, it's Wednesday again. It's that time of the week, and Cheryl is finally back from after being ill for a couple of weeks. It's nice to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And we've got Dr. David Tabrett with us today.
Good afternoon, Amanda.
Good afternoon. Now, you are looking at talking about chocolate.
Yes, I love chocolate. So if anyone's cleaning out their cupboard so their dog doesn't get it, send it in.
Well, that sounds good.
I don't think we could do that. We can't solicit donations of chocolate.
No, we can't. But if you just happen to drop it on the ground near us, you know.
Away from dogs.
And in their wrapper. Now, Cheryl, you have got a snake brooch on today.
I have. Look, I have a real fear of snakes. And as David knows, this time last year, my dog was in the vets.
Oh. Very, very distressing.
Yes, it was. Mm. And I saw a snake this week. So I just thought.
Oh.
I know.
Very late in the season now.
Well, I don't think it is, David. I think things are changing because it was this time last year and I saw this big snake cross the road at Hillsborough the other day.
At Hillsborough?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Keep an eye out.
Yeah. So that's what I'm going to talk about.
Cheryl Shaw and Dr. David Tabrett are here with us on 2NURFM. But we're going to start with talking about snakes, Cheryl.
Yeah, look, I absolutely hate snakes and I know a lot of people love them. My daughter has them as pets, but I had a dog who was bitten last year and I thought, oh, this is unusual. You know, this April, you know, it's not so hot. We often think about snakes in the December, January, laying out sunbaking. But no, they're around. I actually saw a great big one the other day and it just made me aware that I need to just mention it to people to make sure that if their dog or their cat is, you know, obviously in an area that could potentially have snakes, like if you have a lot of gardens like I do, rocks, you know, you've got a woodshed, things like that, the snakes love those areas.
Do you have a pond?
I have a fountain and several ponds.
So water... A water source is often what attracts them.
Yes.
And obviously food, i.e.
frogs,
mice, etc. Yeah.
Yep. And also I have an aviary, so that's another thing that can contribute to the snakes.
Right.
But this snake I saw the other day was actually going across the road and it went into somebody's yard. And it made me aware of just what's going on in Newcastle at the moment. We've got a lot of things happening. If you look at Mile Road, there's a lot of roadkill on the road there at the moment where they're doing all of that, you know, demolition to make new building area.
Mm.
Now, the animals that live in there, the wildlife, are being displaced.
Mm.
So they're often finding new homes. So do be, you know, really aware of what your dog and cat's doing in the yard. If suddenly they're, you know, spending a lot of time in a particular area, make sure that you go and investigate it. Now, look, snakes are protected, so you can't go and grab the shovel and do something naughty. You'll have to call in somebody, a professional.
Also, they're very dangerous.
Yes.
So people who present to hospital with snake bite, like, no, I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's something like 90% of them have tried to do something with the snake.
Mm.
They've tried to interact with the snake. Grab it or to hit it with something, stay away. Just give them space. And as you said, you can actually get a licensed snake catcher to come and move the snake to a safer area.
Often people from wires will take them, I think.
Yeah, well, if they're injured, but the ones that
need
just removal.
All right.
Yeah.
And look, dogs and cats have a natural instinct to hunt things down. But what's interesting about snakes give off an odour that we don't normally notice, but the odour is to prevent them from being attacked by other animals. And dogs in particular are good at picking up that scent. They'll pick up the scent and go for it. Now, even if you think the snake is dead, it isn't always dead and you should not let your dog near it because the venom can still have an effect on the dog. So what happens there, David? What's the story on that?
Well, there have been plenty of cases where even a scratch from a dead snake, as you said, because the venom comes from modified salivary glands and it's... funneled down or channeled down into a groove in their canine tooth, I guess, their fangs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, how it can be delivered. But at that point, it's also then on the surface of the snake tooth in its mouth, etc. So, you know, it's easily enough if you, a dog, did attack even a dead snake, there's still risk from a venomous snake that it could be injured or envenomated.
Right. Now, with the venom that that the dog is, you know, that it gets on it, or the snake bites it and it goes in, what are the signs that people should be looking for when they're finding a dog that it may be like maybe puncture wounds or what sort of things do we look for?
Well, most of the time we don't see or find puncture wounds. And that's partly because our dogs have fur, etc. Sometimes they're quite small as well. Generally, the signs that we see depend very much on the species of the snake that has bitten them. So the most common venomous snake in our area, coastal at least, is probably the red-belly black snakes. And then when we look at further up the valley, for instance, we'll see brown snakes. But even that, I've had dog bites, patients present with snake bite that have been proven to be brown snake, and they are in suburban Newcastle. So even this occurs where we've got this geographic overlap. So from a kind of clinical symptoms or signs that you might notice, a collapse would be the first thing. Vomiting is another symptom. And then it's progressive things like progressive paralysis and tissue damage that leads to blood problems and eventually kidney and bladder. So they're bleeding or there's muscle damage and their urine starts to turn red. Oftentimes by that stage, you know, you already know there's a problem. They're having respiratory difficulty because their muscles aren't working, that sort of thing. They could be bleeding from orifices like their eyes, their nose, dogs that vomit blood or have diarrhea or pass blood.
I remember with my dog, one of the things that I noticed in particular for him was it was like he had really strange eyes. He was just staring and not blinking. It was this really unusual eye contact that we were having. It was sort of a little bit like, why are you looking at me like that? It was a weird sensation to look into his eyes.
Yeah, the snake venom is quite complex, thousands of different toxins, generally grouped into five different effects, I guess, based on, you know, which major organ they're going to affect. And different snakes, again, across species, have different mixture of these toxins, and that kind of is, you know, the characteristic of, say, a brown snake bite or the characteristic of a black snake bite. But as I mentioned, we're starting to actually see crossover between some of these venom effects and the symptoms that are not typical. And partly I think that's not because there's been any great change in the snakes or interbreeding or anything like that. I think it's just because it's always been that way, and we've just now got more people, and as you said, displaced snakes out of habitat are now coming into contact in suburbia, and so we've actually got more patients to look at.
And so the data is being more...
And from our experience in the emergency hospital, we do see that. We're seeing far more patients with snake bite. I think also to add to that is that people recognise the signs in their pets earlier.
Yes.
And so they're actually bringing them in as fast as they can. Because, for instance, for brown snakes, which are highly venomous, probably the, you know, one of the most dangerous snakes in the world, from the time of a bite to the time when they your pet could die could be as short as 15 minutes.
And even if you think your pet has been bitten and seems okay, it's still really important to get to the vet, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a thing that happens with snake bite called pre-paralytic syndrome, where the dog will have an encounter, get bitten, again, that you may not observe that. They vomit, collapse, and then they get up and they look all right. And they'll run around, they look all right. And if anyone brings their dog in and they say, well, he did this and I was thought there might have been a snake and then he collapsed, but he's all right now, just want you to check him out, those are the ones that we are like, oh, my God, get ready. This is not going to be very good. So we need to act really quickly. And so we do see that from time to time. And that indicates they've had a massive envenomation. So... yeah, you've got to be very astute and watch your pets all the time. Cats are a whole different ballgame. Still suffer the effects, but oftentimes the effects or the onset of symptoms can be quite delayed.
Oh, how interesting.
We might talk more about that after.
Yep.
We've got Margaret on the line from Glendale. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for holding.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. You've got a couple of questions for Dr. David today.
I have. I'm just wondering, with the tick and flea tablets that you give the dogs, is there a season or should you just give it to them every month of the year?
Which area do you live in, Glendale, Margaret?
Yeah.
Every month of the year?
Yeah.
Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is because when we're living coastal predominantly, we're seeing tick patients. Well, first of all, fleas. We'll see fleas very often through the year. But also the way the flea life cycle is affected, your preventatives need to be there all the time.
Okay.
So if you want to make sure, if you just wait till when you see fleas, you're way too late. Okay.
Yeah, right.
So that's the other thing. And then with ticks, we do see a kind of more of a distinct season. But having said that, we see tick patients come in the door every single week of the year.
Yeah, that's the one that worries me more than
likely. Yeah, very much so. Now, to counter that, you know, I understand that that, you know, can get a bit costly in terms of the preventatives year-round. Yep. And sometimes people will hold off on doing some prevention because of that. But as soon as you add in, well, the risk of a tick intoxication, tick paralysis comes on and what it costs in terms of treatment, you're going to be miles ahead. And I think the other thing I've seen over the past number of years is that the season, if we can call it that, seems to be getting longer. It's earlier in the year. We see plenty of tick patients coming in August. And I think probably 20 years ago we didn't see that so much, but we're seeing this tick season all year round. We live in areas that have got a lot of ticks endemically. You know, there's bandicoots in our region as well, and they're a natural host for ticks. A lot of lizards will carry ticks. Birds will carry ticks. So they're here, and the best way to look after our pets is to make sure they're on a very good tick preventative. And in addition to the monthly, you know, there's like the 3 monthlies. Now we can actually get an injection that'll last them through the year as well. So, you know, you've got a number of options, and I think on a risk-benefit or even a cost-benefit ratio, treatment continuously is absolutely 100% the way to go.
Great. Well, that answers that question.
Yep.
Many different things. And the other one is, when do you go from giving your animal, your dog, puppy food to adult food?
So by puppy food, do you mean like commercial puppy food that you buy?
The biscuits and or the wet food as well.
Yep. Okay. This is a huge topic.
Yeah.
I'm going to upset some people. It's kind of life has been made easy because we can actually go to a shop and go, I've got a 6-week-old dog or an 8-week-old dog or, you know, 3 months old, 12 weeks, and there's the food. It's on the shelf in front of me. So then you've got this one that's like for 6-month-old dog and a food for 1-year-old dogs and so on. There are actually, if we come back to it from the scientific side, is that we know that pups and like kids, right? They have a greater demand for things like calcium.
Yep.
And whenever we feed calcium, we also have to pay attention to phosphorus, because if we mix up that balance, we can cause kidney damage. So they've got a greater demand for calcium. They've got a greater demand for protein. Feeding protein is expensive, and long-term high-protein diets, dogs are not suited to that. And it can actually start to cause things like kidney damage and liver damage. That we never really get into that, but it's kind of like, you know, if you just fed straight meat, for instance, for like 10 years, your dog's going to have kidney disease, no doubt. It's really just more about, you know, tweaking it a little bit. In terms of in a timeline, I'm thinking if they're under 12 months of age, that's reasonable, but it could even be 6 months. It depends on the breed. Depends on the size of the dog.
Yeah.
If you've got more than one dog, you've got, you know, a pup and then you've got other dogs on adult food, a lot of those dogs, I notice, they'll they'll either self-transfer themselves over, or people just go, oh, I'm tired of buying the puppy food, I'm just going to buy the other one. So, I don't know. Cheryl, what do you...
Yeah, what breed of dog do you have, Margaret?
She's a Maltipoo.
Okay, so she's a small breed dog. I like to keep puppies on their pet food for about 18 months.
For me,
that's
one
how...
Another 6 months.
So that's how I do it. But, I mean, you know, I just know that they need that high energy that, as a puppy. They tend to burn up more energy, so they need more fat and protein content in that time period. And then after that, you know, they go onto an adult formula for quite a long time and then onto a senior formula, because you're looking at how active the dog is and how much it's burning up in that time, you know, period.
So from a calorie intake perspective?
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing, and this doesn't quite apply, Margaret, for yourself, but with certain breeds, like larger dogs, we also worry about bone and cartilage disorders. So our feeding is a bit more controlled in terms of their calorie intake, protein, fat ratios. But that's a really good point that Cheryl just made, is their energy... As a pup, they're burning a lot up, and so it's much easier to do supply those calories through fat and protein.
Right. Well, you've answered both my questions.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling.
Thanks,
you.
Margaret.
Thanks, Margaret. Bye-bye.
And, David, we're going to talk about chocolate.
My favourite condiment, confectionery, I should say, this time of the year. Yes, and one of my favourite topics. Working in emergency practice for 20-something years, we've seen a lot of chocolate poisoning. And it's no great pleasure to see them come in, poor things. So just a kind of a little bit of background. I mean, why is chocolate poisonous to dogs? First of all, it seems grossly unfair. But also, it's also tasty to dogs too. So double whammy. Because once they've eaten it, it could poison them. It also means that I have less. And so what actually happens is, contained within chocolate are a family of chemicals called methyl xanthanes, right? And so some of those are actually quite stimulant. Now, in people, it does have a little bit of an effect, gives you a bit of a buzz, you know, feel happy. Causes release of serotonin, things like that. But in dogs, it kind of goes a bit overboard, and they can actually start to stimulate the muscles and the nerves. So dogs that present with chocolate poisoning they'll develop tremors or fine fasciculations, we call them, on the skin. They can progress into full-blown tremors, seizures. They can also develop cardiac arrhythmias, so abnormal heart rhythm, where their heart starts racing and their heart rate goes from a normal of, say, 100 or 120 up to 300.
Wow.
300 beats per minute. That's 5 beats per second. Mm. And the key thing there is, when your heart's beating that fast, it doesn't have time. There's no time to fill the heart with blood. So their cardiac output drops dramatically and they'll collapse. And unfortunately, the heart rhythm just gets faster and faster and faster. And that can actually cause, I guess we'd call it a heart attack. So they can develop that. They can also develop a coma.
What's a coma?
Well, where they'll actually lose consciousness. And, you know, at that stage, we're really quite worried that they're going to die pretty imminently. But we can treat them. And very much the earliest treatment is, we want to purge the chocolate out of their body and then try and control these symptoms that I talked about. There's no antidote, okay? So it's really just about, first of all, prevention, emergency treatment, and then they may need to be in hospital for a period of time. The other thing about chocolate is that these chemicals, as they get processed through and excreted through the kidney into the bladder, they can actually come in the urine. They're sitting there in the urine in the bladder. They'll actually get absorbed through the bladder wall back into the bloodstream. Mm. And so then they can poison them again. So they'll have a chocolate incident where they eat some chocolate that's dangerous and they're in hospital. They can actually be under the effects of it for up to 5 days.
Wow.
Wow,
from
that's a
one
long time.
Ingestion.
Long time. Yeah. So how much chocolate are we talking about? Are we talking about a lick? Or are we talking about
it depends.
A little Easter egg?
It depends. There's three variables, okay? One is the size of the dog, okay? The second thing, so the smaller the dog, the more likely you'll get toxicity. Second thing is the type of chocolate and how much of these chemicals are contained within that chocolate, okay? And then the third thing is how much of the chocolate they actually eat. So when we say chocolate, we could think of, say, milk chocolate. Okay, it's not safe, but of those, it's lowered on the list, and there is a limit to the amount that a dog might eat. That is before it becomes dangerous. But I'm going to say the limit's zero. All right, let's not play around with saying, oh, they can have one bit of chocolate. No, zero. White chocolate, funnily enough, is not going to cause these symptoms. Okay, it has heaps of sugar and heaps of fat, but it's not going to poison them. And then we move up from milk chocolate to dark chocolate, and then cooking cocoa, yeah, or those, they're the really toxic ones. So the dark chocolate and so on. And I've seen dogs that have actually eaten all three of those in one sitting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did they raid the Easter Bunny's basket?
Yeah, or someone's cooking in the house around this
time. Yeah, like your chocolate brownies, things like that. Mm, that would be really dangerous. I hadn't thought about the chocolate brownie.
Yeah, the cocoa powder is highly toxic. So you just got to make sure they don't get access to it at all. That's really the fundamental thing. And if you do that, that means there's more left for you.
But also just making sure that where you're storing these Easter eggs they're distributed, that the dog doesn't get access to, because they'll sniff them out.
They'll sniff them out, and I've had a number of people have presented their pets following, you know, where they've broken into sealed containers, shredded the container, eaten all the chocolate. We bring them into hospital, make them vomit. The chocolate comes up, but so does the wrappers. And even I've had bits of container come up like plastic that they've chewed through. The other thing is when we make them vomit, that's not the end of the story, because the chocolate actually, dissolves pretty quickly at body temperature, and it starts to get absorbed through the stomach wall almost immediately. So we make them vomit, but that's not going to be the only treatment.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line. Chris from Katara, thanks for holding. Now, you've got an 18-month-old female Dachshund.
You've
had for one season, and you want to know the best time to breed her.
Yeah, she's a beautiful one, and I would love to breed with her. She's a really nice dash hound. It's a miniature, but no idea when.
So when was her last cycle? When did she last be on season? Oh, have we lost Chris?
You there, Chris?
10 months old.
Oh, Tim.
Oh, sorry, Tim. So it was 8 months ago. So generally, you know, we always kind of say, well, they'll cycle every 6 months, twice a year. But some dogs only do cycle once a year.
Okay.
Now, so she could be in that boat, or she might start to cycle any time from today. Like there's no rule about it. At this point, now there is in dogs that are actually do have a delayed season, and it's not really delayed if it's 12 months, but if it goes over that, it is. Then we kind of a little bit concerned about what's going on hormonally. Now the beauty of that is in the past we kind of really had crude assessment methods. Nowadays we can do blood tests and measure the level of hormones and just see where they're up to in their cycle. And so it depends how much you want to do. How much do you want to get, you know, breeding with her?
Well, I'd certainly like to within the next 12 months or so. I just thought she was a bit young, that's all.
They often say around two is this time, but, you know, prior to that, they're still very young, and because she hasn't developed her cycle, pattern or routine, you'd want to wait until you know what that is. And like David
that's
said, having
point.
Some tests.
Yeah, so it might be the third cycle before you do that.
Yeah.
Because the first cycle went through war and peace at our place. So much stuff. My God, doonas, monkeys, toys, blankets, everything. 6 weeks.
Well, that certainly sounds pretty strange hormonally. But again, if that's her first cycle, then, you know, any options up for grabs. It's kind of that pattern that you want to see what happens over the next 6 to 12 months.
No worries.
And that'll probably give you the best outcome to wait until that third cycle.
Okay, good luck. Good luck with that.
Yeah, keep the doonas up and things like that.
And Chris, you might decide that breeding's not for you and do sexing's for her.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get a lot of black sheets.
Thanks very much, Chris. This is Pet Chat on 2 and URFM, and we have Kate from Brankston on the line. Hi, Kate.
Hi there.
You want to know what's a good ratio of kibble to protein for your dog?
That's right. I was just listening to you talk about too much protein, and I tend to give my dog a lot of chicken for breakfast and chicken for dinner.
Yep.
So I'm just listening to that and thinking, what ratio should it be? One meal of each, or should I be putting rice and vegetables in his meal?
When we talk, and this is what we were picking up earlier, when we talk about protein levels and carbohydrate and fat, it's very much dependent on the age of the dog, the breed, or it's actually the body conformation is what we were most interested in, because we do know that dogs at different ages and different body conformations will have different needs for protein levels and growth rates associated with fat, protein, carbohydrate. So the point I wanted to get to with this is it's not a one kind of rule that applies across everyone. And usually what we'll talk to people about is once we know those breed details and the body size and the age, then we can tailor that ratio, if you like. Because just remembering is in the kibble, when we talk about kibble, which is kind of like a catch-all phrase for dry dog food.
Sure.
You know, there's so much variability with the dry dog food that some of them already have high protein. And when I'm saying, you know, 30%. Like puppy foods usually sit at around about 30%. Okay, maybe they even struggle to get to 30% with protein levels. And they'll have high fat ratios. For an adult dog, our protein level probably needs to be down around about 15, 16, no more than
20%. Okay. So can you get kibble that is just vegetarian kibble?
I could mix the
chicken.
Yeah, look, I think you still always work out. You've got to allow for it. But the problem we see with when we go to a pure carbohydrate kibble, and I know that's not what you're talking about as far as, you know, vegetarian, i.e. not meat.
Yeah.
But there are actually non-meat protein sources that we use. Even rice, for instance, has protein.
Mm.
Okay.
Right, yeah.
So that's why it is a more complex subject than just saying, well, feed this, one meal of this and one meal of that. And volume, of course, is probably, when we say ratio, that doesn't really consider volume. So,
no, well, he's only 6 kilos, so he's only little.
What breed of dog is it, Kate?
He's a Japanese chin.
Oh, okay. Oh, they're lovely little dogs.
Oh. I haven't seen one of them for a long
time.
They're
beautiful dogs.
Yeah,
he's a character.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit worried now because I predominantly just give him chicken.
Yeah. You often find that with a dog that's getting a lot of chicken, they can develop a lot of allergies and can become quite itchy. So if that's something that starts to happen, and often with the little the chins, you can see on their feet, sometimes their feet actually have a funny yellow tinge to it, a little bit feathery looking. So just keep an eye on that. You'd know then if you're giving too much chicken. But I would be giving another source of protein as well, not just the chicken.
Yeah, there's...
He does eat a mix, really, but he's 9, so he's not a baby.
Yeah.
I think, again, if we go back to the proteins, the kibble, and we're just using that catch-all phrase, my motto is you get what you pay for. Okay, so the quality of the ingredients and the quality of the manufacturing is improved, and that's it. When you get a better quality product, it's going to cost you a little bit more. But because it is of better quality, it actually has a higher digestibility. And a simple definition of digestibility is what goes in versus what comes out at the other end. And you want a high digestibility product. So that's a better quality product. It means that you actually feed less. Okay, and so then your protein supplement becomes more, you know, if it's chicken wings, for instance, it's a treat. Right. It's not a substantial part of the diet.
Yes, look, I buy a good kibble, but it is one that he likes, the one with salmon in it. So it must have a, you know, a fair bit of protein in it as well.
It, absolutely. There you go. So you've already probably covered it off 90% of the time anyway.
Okay, thanks for that, Kate. We are almost out of time. We've got about 50 seconds. We'll just quickly go to our pet of the week. We've got Drax, who is a 12-week-old cat, beautiful little black cat, fluffy coat,
perfect. Very, very confident, child-friendly, and even dog-friendly.
Mm.
Yeah, we don't get pets come through with that qualification in the past or very often. So
No.
Should be so, a popular choice for someone out there who's looking for a cat.
And we've got Hunter, a Staffordshire Bull Terrier Cross. Beautiful dog, loves water.
Yeah, so I noticed this, Amanda. His water habits are something to be, you know, observed and enjoyed, because he just loves to get into the water.
He does. And if you'd like to check out our Pets of the Week, you can go to 2NURFM.com.au and have a look at them. We are out of time. Congratulations to Margaret from Glendale. You've won our $50 pet food voucher. And we'll catch you next week on 2NURFM for Pet Chat.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.